BCFM. Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries. The very highest degrees of which combined together make up a secret order known as the Illuminati.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Queen alone gets tens of millions in EU agricultural subsidies, so why has the coalition government turned down EU help with food banks? Work and Pensions Secretary Ian Duncan Smith slipped out of the chamber of the House of Commons this week as they debated food banks, leaving his assistant Esther McVeigh to carry the can for him. And there's nothing we're told she can do to put food on our tables except encourage those cut off from benefits, the disabled and the mentally ill too, to go out and get a job. Also, BBC Points West reports 70 or so people every night sleeping rough in a rainy Bristol city centre while thousands of acres of office space stand empty. Plus, what if every soldier in the world were given the order to put down their gun, hop out of their tank and shake the hand of their enemy over a drink? Well, it sounds ridiculous, but on Christmas Day back in 1914, soldiers in World War I did it of their own accord. Somerset woman Freya Lawton joins us and she's determined to make it happen. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his tour of the weekly world's hotspots, I imagine including Africa and Ukraine. But first, I'm joined by Mark Goodway. He's the founder of the Matthew Tree Project in Easton, which manages several food stores, not actually food banks. What's the difference between a food store and a food bank, Matthew?
Okay, well, the Matthew Tree Project was established 2.5 years ago to address the underlying causes of poverty. So what a food store does is actually provide more longer-term support for somebody that's in at risk of extreme poverty, i.e. homelessness. So a food bank would give an emergency 3-day food parcel to somebody, which is very important work, and we've also heard about how that need is increasing. What the food stores do is actually go one step further than that. So for people that need more support than a 3-day food parcel, we will actually support them for longer, whether it's weeks or whether it's months. We provide food while we're doing that. But what we're seeking to do is to actually build a relationship with each individual client and understand what the issues are, what the problems are, what the barriers are, and then assist them in actually getting out of the hole they're in for good.
So is the idea that the food banks are there to provide the emergency help and you're there as a more permanent solution?
Yeah, more long-term solution, absolutely. So where somebody's got more deep entrenched issues, then we are there to actually help them grapple with that. We provide practical assistance like food. We help people budget better. We help people cook from scratch at home, nutritious, healthy meals on a budget. And we provide other essential items like cookers and fridges and freezers if they don't have that. So what we do is we understand the situation, see where the assistance is needed, provide that. But fundamentally, what we're trying to do is empower somebody to take control of their situation and work their way into a better place.
Well, that's not always possible, though, is it? Because a lot of this is just about whether the sums add up or not, whether the money's coming in. For example, we hear that 700,000 people across Britain have been cut off completely from benefits. They've been sanctioned for one reason or another, and the government says to them, well, there's going to be just no money for you this week or for the next 4 weeks or for the next couple of months. And so how do you actually help somebody in that sort of situation who's just got no money coming in at all?
Well, that is the challenge, and it is an almost impossible challenge with the situation the way it is. What we can do is make sure they don't go hungry. We can also actually, you know, the thing is that the position they're in, and there's nothing they can do about that. And really, from our point of view, they either in that situation alone, or we can be there with them. We don't have any magic wand, or we don't have a rabbit we can pull out of a hat. But what we can do is we can actually walk that walk with them and support them and help them wherever we possibly can. And it's surprising, actually, that when you can instill a sense of hope and a sense of empowerment in somebody, how they can actually walk through such a dark valley as that.
Well, do you feel that we've got a bit of an atomised society out there, with people sort of living very individual lives, maybe without that family support that was possibly there in previous generations, and that you're there really to stand by them, almost as if a member of the family, to sort of to discuss the problems with them and almost actually be there for them? Because I think for a lot of people, they're used to the nanny state. Some people are anyway. And when that suddenly is cut off, they feel very depressed and very lonely.
Yeah, but one of the symptoms of poverty is isolation. And somebody that goes on the slippery slope down that route, they will lose their support structure around them. Just like you said, their family and friends, that will dissipate. So what we've actually done is created, if you like, a community. So we're there for them. But in actual fact, what we actually see on a weekly basis is as they come to the food stores, they actually start to get into relationship with each other as well. When we do the cooking classes, we actually do it in a very social way. So they work together, they learn together, and they eat together at the end. So we do try very hard to create a social dimension to everything that we do, recognising that that is such an important part of life.
Whereabouts is the Matthew Tree Project?
Well, we actually now have six in Bristol. They are in St Jude's, Knowle West, Withywood, Brislington, Cadbury Heath, and Hengrove.
And whereabouts does the food come from to there? Do you have to actually go out and buy the food?
No. We are a charity, so we have very, very few funds. All the food is donated. So you know, when you actually look at the Matthew Tree and the number of people, I mean, it's over 700 people a month now that we're actually supporting and feeding. The number of people that go into making that happen is huge, in whether it's volunteers giving time or whether it's people donating food or donating money. And each food store will have a network around it where people will donate directly to the food store. So that would be churches, schools, businesses, individuals. But what we also have is a relationship with Asda in Bristol. So we conduct regular what we call food appeal collections at the Asda stores, where we have volunteers stood at the doorway. And as the customers come in, we simply introduce ourselves, give them a shopping list of the items that we need, and ask them if they'd be so kind to buy an extra item or two while they're doing their shopping, and pop it in our basket when they leave. And it's remarkable how...
No, surely the supermarket themselves could quite easily afford to donate some food to you. They're making enormous profits, aren't they?
Well, supermarkets are making lots of profit, absolutely. And to be fair, Asda has donated to us funds. So they have avenues that you can go down to actually bid for assistance. And so, you know, we're accessing as much of that as we possibly can. But to feed the number of people that we need to feed, we need a lot more than that. And the food that we're able to secure by doing a one-day food collection is about half a ton of food. So, you know, so we got a very big van, and we turn up in the morning with it empty and drive away in the end of the afternoon with it completely full up. And that hasn't cost us anything other than our time. And also the other thing as well is that I think it's a positive indictment on society that when you actually got so many people so willing to give and help those less fortunate, that's actually a good thing. So in some respects, we're giving people an opportunity to help somebody else, and that in itself can't be undervalued.
Okay, so you've said that some of your funding comes from Asda. Whereabouts else are you funded from?
Well, up to now, we've been funded mostly by donation, again, churches, individuals. We've been successful with a few funding bids, but not many. But you know, the biggest resource that we need to make this happen is food. So if you look at our latest set of accounts, over 50% of our income is actually food, which is donated in kind. So you know, it's the supply of food that we generally need, because the rest of the charity is driven by volunteers. So we don't have a huge wage bill or anything like that. I mean, we have overhead, rent and petrol for the van and insurances and all that sort of thing. But we work very hard to keep our costs down. And fundamentally, with for donated food and an army of volunteers, this can happen.
What about the way you've seen things change over the last few years, or last couple of years? And where did you first start, I should ask you?
Yeah, we launched our first food store 2.5 years ago, June 2018.
Right. So, yeah, how have you seen things change since then?
Well, what we've noticed, we do keep very detailed records of the crisis that's driving people to us. And what we've seen is a big increase in the reason why people come to us is because of welfare changes, benefit delays, benefit changes or sanctions. So, you know, over 23% of our clients are at our door because they've had their benefits cut or reduced to the point where they can't survive. And, you know, that is a worrying situation.
Yeah, I was saying in the first hour that, I mean, well, I was signing on and I was sanctioned as benefits. But it seems to take a very, very long time for an appeal to actually go through. Even though I finally won my appeal, you're in the situation there where you've got quite a lot of time with actually no income from your benefits at all.
Yeah, and that is the worry. I mean, of all the people listening to this, if they were to think how if I had to go 12 weeks with no income at all, how would I survive that? I'm sure a lot of people listening to this wouldn't be able to. But that is the reality for thousands of people now across the country, and you know it is almost an impossible situation for people to be in. So, you know, we are fighting a huge battle here. But what we are finding is that if we come alongside somebody, give them essentials like food and encouragement and help, and you know we have a network of partnership organisations that work with us as well now, so we are able to provide quite a lot of support through that period of great need.
Give us some examples of the people that come to you.
Well, I mean, every situation is different. We have families. We have families with three or four or five children. We have individuals. We got all age ranges. So we got 16-year-olds right up to 60-year-olds, and male, female. We've got people that are in work. We've got people that are out of work. We've got single mothers. We've got domestic abuse victims. Lots of people come to us because they've got tremendous debt problems. You know, they've got eviction orders hanging over their heads. And we've got a lot of people come to us that are actually in work but signed off work ill because of the stress of the situation that they're trying to cope with. And of course, that's a vicious circle then. So I think, you know, you can basically say every category of person, and of course the addiction agencies are also referral agencies to us, so people that are in programs that come out of addiction, they also can be referred to us, so we could help in those as well.
How do you decide between who's deserving and who's undeserving of access to your food bank, food stores?
Yeah, food stores. Yeah, that obviously is the big challenge. We work by referral only, so we have a network of agencies, frontline agencies that work with vulnerable people.
So you mentioned the addiction agencies. What are the others? Like, you're talking about things like Citizens Advice and that kind of thing?
Yeah, Citizens Advice, Bureau of Red Cross, Avon and Somerset Probation Trust. We've got the City Council, Bristol City Council, Tenant Support Services, the Asylum Team. Age UK, you know, all of the big agencies, plus you've got St Mungo's, Second Step, all the agencies that would be helping people that maybe are trying to get rehoused or trying to stay housed. Also doctor surgeries, health centres, schools, churches. So it's any organisation that would come into contact with somebody in a way where they actually get to know their details, they understand their situation. And the referral criteria is quite simple, is that if somebody's income is less than the essential outgoings, so there's a shortfall, and which inevitably means that they're actually going, the shortfall is normally always food, then they can be referred to us for help.
Now, there was a debate this week. Ian Duncan Smith, in the House of Commons, Ian Duncan Smith, the independent reporter, left the debate on food banks early this week. He's the Work and Pensions Secretary. Jonathan Page, writing on Wednesday in the Independent, said Tory ministers have been condemned for not taking the plight of Britain's poor seriously after a rowdy Commons debate on food banks, during which Ian Duncan Smith refused to answer questions and left early. As Fiona McTaggart, the Labour MP for Slough, described how people battled over energy end-of-day bargains in her local Tesco, she was almost drowned out by laughter and jeering from the government benches. Ms McTaggart could barely be heard over the braying as she described how the supermarket had been forced to draft in extra security and asked, isn't that a shocking sign in the 21st century? Labour MP for Copeland in Cumbria, Jamie Reid, told the Daily Mirror that he regrets to say that the laughter from the government benches says more about this issue than words ever could. Ian Duncan Smith and the remaining government ministers from his department left the debate after an hour well before it concluded. Barry Gardner, the Labour MP for Brent, said it was extraordinary to see Mr Duncan Smith smirking as it was pointed out that 500,000 people are now using food banks, and the minister refused to answer any questions directly, instead leaving them to be fielded by his deputy Esther McVeigh. The Trussell Trust, the nation's largest provider of food banks with almost 400 branches, said it was disappointed by the attitude of those who jeered. Martin.
Well, I mean, obviously there's fairly sharp political points being made there. I think it's great that organisations like the Matthew Tree Project exist. What's the source of the name? It's got sort of biblical reference, has it?
Well, yeah, we are a faith-based charity.
So why the Matthew Tree? I'm just curious to know.
Okay. When I decided to establish the charity, I wanted to convey a number of things in the name. Mm-hmm. First of all, I wanted to convey what I believe to be the most fundamental biblical principles of all, which is to love each other. Mm-hmm. And there's a passage of scripture in Matthew's Gospel.
Yeah.
It's very famous, if you know the Bible, sheep and the goats, where, you know, if somebody's hungry, you feed them. If they're thirsty, you give them
drink. I see.
And the tree, I wanted a very positive symbol, but I also wanted to convey that it's all about compassion. Mm-hmm. And if you look at our logo, you will see that in the tree, in Japanese writing, so it looks a bit like branches, is the word love.
Okay.
So that's why I chose
it. All right, well, the reason I mentioned that is because what you're doing reminds me of the Catholic Cardinal of Recife, Dom Helder Camara, who was in the 1960s. And the early 70s, and he said, when I give the poor food, they call me a saint. When I ask why they're hungry, they call me a communist. And of course, he was part of the liberation theology movement in Latin America. Yeah. And I think it's great. I mean, you are, in a way, if it was to be negative about it, you could say the sort of thing you're doing is the big society. So the state withdraws support from all these poor people and you step into the breach. And in a way, the government ought to be patting you on the back and saying, that's great. But of course, they don't really want to hear what's going on, do they? I mean, that's what I take from what Tony was reading earlier. Yeah. There's a disconnect between the people at the top and the people at the bottom. And, you know, society is fractured by that lack of compassion.
The Mirror this week published some facts and figures about food banks in Britain in the run-up to that debate, which the government ministers ducked out of, which was the food bank uses in the South East, the region known for its wealth and relative prosperity, is up 60% just in 2013. A decade ago, food banks were almost unheard of in the UK. It opens new food banks in Britain every week, the Trussell Trust, now, to cope with the increase in referrals. The government commissioned a report into the rise of food bank use in June this year, but the government are refusing to publish the results of their report. It was also investigated by DEFRA. Thousands of families face the prospect of relying on emergency food handouts this Christmas. I mean, Mark, is this your experience at the Matthew Tree?
Yeah, the demand's going up all the time. And, you know, we simply can't keep pace with it. So what we're having to do is the resources we have, the food we have, we're constantly having to relook at the clients that we have and target the food that we have to the ones most in need. So whereas, say, 6 months ago, we would have been feeding somebody, now we're not able to simply because we don't have enough food. And it's got that bad, and it's very difficult to actually say to somebody, we can't help you because there's more people here, more in need than you are, and we just don't have enough food to go around.
Yeah, one of the side effects of all this, Martin, of course, when people don't have any kind of income, they're really desperate just to put some food on the table, is that they may go into the black market or even to organised crime.
Well, I imagine that most of the people coming to food banks are not those who've gone to the black market to supplement their incomes.
If there's no food, for example.
Yeah, but I mean, of course, but what is happening? I mean, for lots of young people, the idea of going, for example, to sign on and be harassed to do jobs that you don't want to do, that you're not qualified for or what have you, or be sanctioned, it's much easier to just go and deal some drugs on the street corner and earn a lot of money, isn't it? And I'm afraid that is that's the real danger, is that we're going to gradually create a society where, as in the United States of America, we know you can't rely on the state to help you, so you help yourself, and that includes taking a gun and going and robbing the local 7-Eleven.
Okay, well, there's also some more figures from the Mirror. 500,000 people received emergency food assistance from a Trussell Trust food bank between April and December 2013. This is more than the entire number assisted the year before, which was about 350,000. Figures from the Trussell Trust show, and it sounds to me like they're echoing what you're saying there, Mark, is that the changes to the benefit system are the most common cause for food bank use in Britain. Nearly a third have been referred after benefits have been delayed, and 19% due to being benefits cut or stopped due to sanctions. It may not be an easy question to answer, but how do you think, if you had the ear of Ian Duncan Smith or the government, after he'd finished smirking at the facts, what would you be saying to him?
Well, my message to the Department of Work and Pensions, and actually I did have a meeting there about 6 weeks ago. I didn't actually speak to Ian Duncan Smith, but one of his advisors. My message to them is that the policies that they currently are pursuing are counterproductive, and that what I'm saying by that is that we all have the same objective. We want to see people in work, good work, supporting themselves, proud of what they do, and you know, if we're trying to encourage people into work, pulling the rug out from underneath them isn't going to help, because you know it's hard enough to get a job these days. And you know, if you were to say take away somebody's income completely and say, well, you know, you've got to go and get a job, you're making the situation virtually impossible. So what my message to them is that the objective of getting people into work, this is counterproductive. We're actually pushing people further away from that by doing this. We're not actually bringing them closer to what we actually all want. And you know, what needs to happen is a much more understanding approach needs to be taken to this, so that people are helped from being on benefits into work, as opposed to browbeaten and sanctioned and told off for not getting a job.
Well, this all came up. Certainly, the message of food was mentioned at Prime Minister's questions again this week. Nick Betts brought up the point of children these days with no food.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. At the end of November, I visited Handsworth Community Sports College in my constituency. The head, Anne Quayle, told me of the school collecting food to help their needy families over Christmas. And indeed, they will have a food bank on the school site in the new year. What really shocked me when she told me of a young girl, aged 15, who arrived on a Monday just before my visit, not having eaten all weekend because there was no food in the house. How does the Prime Minister expect that young girl to fulfil her educational potential?
Well, we've got to do everything we can to help Britain's families, to help those, to help families into work, and that's exactly what we're doing under this government. And we also have to make sure that we protect the income levels of the poorest, and that's why, for instance, the child tax credit is up £390 under this government, protecting the money that goes to the poorest people in our country.
Martin, we're one of the richest countries in the world. How come we're ending up with the situation with children who've come to school on a Monday having had no food through the weekend?
Well, frankly, it's ideological blinkeredness. I mean, as has just been pointed out, this is not the way to get people into work. It's a silly policy, and for many, you know, for a generation, we haven't done it like this. We're going back to how we used to do it 50, 70 years ago, and we didn't like it, and it didn't work then, and it's not going to work now, that's all I'll say.
There was shouts of Scrooge in the House of Commons on Wednesday when Nick Rainsford pointed out that the Archbishop's both of Westminster and Canterbury were critical of the way that government had been handling the benefits system and the way it was affecting some of the most vulnerable people in the country.
Nick Rainsford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. With the Archbishop of Canterbury reminding us of society's responsibility towards the support of the poor and the vulnerable, and the Archbishop of Westminster specifically criticising the inhumanity of aspects of government policy, does the Prime Minister regret, as we approach Christmas, his government's retreat from the compassionate conservatism he used to adopt?
I don't shouldn't accept what the right honourable gentleman says at all. There is nothing more compassionate than getting more people into work. The best route out of poverty is work, and what we can see for the first time in our country, 30 million people in work. Now, I enjoy debating and listening carefully to our archbishops. I have to say what the Archbishop of Westminster said about immigration I don't agree with, but I think we should be frank and open about these debates and not be concerned when we do have disagreements.
Mark Goodway, founder of the Matthew Tree project here in Bristol. What are your thoughts about that little exchange there? Because he's saying, hang on, you've got archbishops here banging on your door saying you're not doing it right.
Well, I agree. They're not doing it right. And you know, the thing is that many of our clients are actually in work. And the problem is that the levels of pay and the type of work is not enough to cover the cost of living now. We got record numbers of people in part-time employment wanting full-time work but not able to get it. We've even got the crazy situation of 0 hours contracts that are technically people are in work but they're actually not earning anything at all. So, you know, the reality is that the answer to this problem isn't just getting people into work. The answer is getting people into good work that pays well, that actually allows people to earn a living which covers the cost of living. And we're not doing that at the moment.
One of the other things, of course, you're doing is you're providing a venue for people to talk to each other, to feel a bit reassured. Have you got a message for anyone out there who knows someone who's either disabled or possibly on their own, unemployed? How would you suggest that those people are actually, I mean, possibly, maybe, you know, my thoughts are just knock on the door of the person next door, see how they're getting on, make sure they're all right. I mean, we had this dreadful case up in Kingswood a few weeks ago of the woman who'd worked her life, most of her working life as a nurse, and then took an overdose because she'd been cut off from benefits, told that she had to work and compete with the million plus young people who are also in the jobs market.
Yeah. Yeah, it's much easier than people think to actually have a conversation with somebody, and you know, I think that we've as a society we've become more insular right across the board, and I would encourage anyone and everyone to if you know somebody nearby that you think may be on their own, is just to go and say hello and just have a chat. I always make a point of when I'm walking around Bristol, if there's somebody sat on the pavement, is to always say good morning or good afternoon or hello. You know, there's nothing worse than feeling though you don't even exist, then people are just completely ignoring you. And that can happen if you're isolated at home on your own, you don't see somebody for days and days, or if you're actually out in a crowd but nobody to talk to and nobody's taking any notice of you. So I think there's a huge benefit in just being aware of each other and just being more connected, really.
Martin, we've also got this crazy situation announced yesterday. I mean, not really been smashed across the British newspapers yet, but Britain's Conservative, this is from the Russia Today website, Britain's Conservative government's facing a wave of criticism for refusing up to $36 million, well, they love using dollars, that's around about, what, £20 million, in EU food aid. The decision has prompted accusations that the government's sacrificing the needs of the poor in favour of championing an anti-EU ideology. Earlier this week, UK officials declined an offer from Brussels for a donation from the European Union's billion-dollar food aid fund. The money would have been channeled into financing food banks, which have become more and more widespread across the UK since the onset of the economic crisis. Prime Minister David Cameron's government maintained that such aid would be better administered by Britain itself. Measures of this type are better and more efficiently delivered by individual member states than through their own social programmes.
Well, so we're talking about a large chunk of money which could just be put in place right now and a lot of problems could be solved. But of course, that would be problems being solved by the European Union. So that can't be allowed to happen, otherwise people might get the idea that the European Union was good for something, and of course, obviously it isn't. It's just ideology. I mean, it's crazy. There's a note of bitterness creeping in here, frankly, a note of bitterness, because a lot of this stuff is totally unnecessary. The bedroom tax, the changes to the benefit system are deliberately punitive.
But the government aren't actually
against. It's a deliberate attempt at social programming. We're going to make life so miserable for the people at the bottom of the pile that you will fear to fall into that category. And in other words, what you've got, people can't enjoy their wealth unless poverty exists and is seen to be punished. We're going back to the 19th century. Read your Dickens. It's all there.
Yeah, one of the what are your thoughts on that? Because I mean, that some of that money could have been arriving on your doorstep, Mark, down at the Matthew Tree.
Absolutely, I'm staggered, to be honest with you. It's you know, the biggest problem that we have is, as I said before, is keeping up the demand of food. And you know, if money like that was available, that I would have proposed that would be spent on food, so that we had plenty supplies to give to people when they came to us. And you know, if that's just been turned away for no reason, then I think that is absolutely appalling, to be honest.
Martin, we're in a situation where just for the Sandringham estate itself, on its own, the Queen gets something like a £7 million annual subsidy from the EU via the Common Agricultural Policy. So if they'll accept £7 million...
Ian Duncan Smith's wife gets £1.7 million a year, I believe, from the EU agricultural subsidies.
So isn't this a double standard? I mean, they're accepting massive amounts of money from one of the richest, if not the richest people in the world from the EU, but they won't accept a few million, actually 20 million, to help people who are hungry.
Look, there's a real debate is starting to open up across the Western world, and including in Britain, about what our attitudes towards poverty and wealth really should be. We've got criminals at the top who've actually stolen billions, who have been let off and actually encouraged.
Hang on, who's that?
Well, we could name, for example, Bob Diamond from Barclays, for example. They've been convicted of fixing the LIBOR rate. That's just one example. In actual fact, there's lots and lots of other
examples. Well, they've been fined for it, haven't they?
Yes, but being fined is actually...
They have. Barclays were fined.
In other words, this is the point. Nobody has been held to account for any of that. In the 1980s, even, when Reagan was running the United States, several thousand top executives of banks were sent to prison during the savings and loans crisis. So to those who have actually been convicted of criminal behaviour are being allowed to carry on doing what they're doing. People at the bottom who've done nothing are being punished just for being poor. And the idea that, as has been pointed out, all they need to do is get jobs, not true. Even the people in work haven't got enough money because real wages are being forced down. This is class war from the top. Now, ultimately, that will provoke class war from the bottom. And I don't want any crying for mummies when we get there, because there's going to be lots of bloody noses and broken faces.
Well, that's a pretty horrible gaze into Martin's future. What's your thoughts for the future, Mark, from the Matthew Tree?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, I must be honest, that even though the situation is dire and as bad as it is, I do believe that... we will find a way to solve this problem. I think that, you know, what I've been most heartened with over the last 2.5 years is the immense generosity of so many people. And I think, you know, in the end of the day, what the approach I would take is that if we're not going to get the help that we think we deserve, we're going to do this anyway. And fundamentally, I will work myself to a standstill to find a solution for this, so that people have got a better future.
And what would you say to those who are thinking either of that we need some food this weekend, we haven't got food on the table, and also to those who might be thinking about volunteering with you?
Well, I would love to hear from anyone who would like to volunteer. we need volunteers all the time. I would also love to hear from anyone who would like to support us financially, whether that's to help with the cost of running the organisation, or even financially to help us purchase food. That would be fabulous. We actually had our session today in just along the road in St Jude's, which is our biggest food store in Bristol. So we've fed a lot of people today. Over 100 people are going to have food for the next 7 days because of what's happened today. And if anybody wants to come down and actually see how it works and meet some of the clients while they're waiting, I would encourage them to do that, just to see the reality of the situation. And, you know, when people come through the door the very first time, what we see is broken people with absolutely humiliated beyond belief. And over the weeks they come to us, what we see them is gradually build up a strength, a confidence, a self-esteem and a dignity. And we start to see them address these issues as difficult as what they are. So if anybody wants to come along and see how it works, I would encourage them to do that.
Just tell us whereabouts exactly you are then.
Well, in St. Jude's, we are in Great George Street. We're in the Great George Street Mission building, which is at the end of Great George Street with the junction with New Street. And we're in there every Friday. It's important you let us know you come in, so we don't have too many visitors, if you like. But that's where we are in the centre of Bristol, and that's the best one to come to. It's the biggest one, and you get to see a wide variety of situations and services.
Well, Mark Goodway, founder of the Matthew Tree Project, throughout now, pretty much the whole of Bristol. You got, did you say five banks? Six now. Yeah. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thank you.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
Martin, last week we missed our opportunity, didn't we, to talk about... in fact, I missed the opportunity. Let me fess up here about the world's hotspots. Ukraine is all where it's happening. A deal's been signed with the customs agreement, anyway, with Vladimir Putin. It looks like they're going eastwards.
Yes, I mean, there's been, obviously, I've been keeping half an eye on this week. The danger is that the divisions, political divisions in Ukraine between the sort of nationalist West that wants closer links with the EU and the pro-Russian East, which wants closer links with Moscow, could, you know, boil over into some kind of confrontation, which would not be dissimilar, I suppose, to the sort of disagreements we're seeing in a place like Egypt, where there are passionate views on both sides.
The EU is saying, we stand by our family member, the Ukraine. It does seem that what they're doing is they're playing a bit of a game here where they're trying to keep the foot in both camps.
Well, I mean, that's the logical thing for Ukraine to do, is to try and be friendly both with Russia and with the West. But because Russia and the West have a fairly poor relationship, Ukraine finds it very difficult to keep one lot happy. It's like you know, the classic thing you get with three young girls, where one's best friends with the other one and the other one's excluded. If there was less tension between Russia and the West, then the Ukraine situation would be a lot easier.
Well, this subject came up, you guessed it, at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
John Whittingdale. Will my right honourable friend join me in saluting the courage of the hundreds of thousands of people who have been peacefully protesting across Ukraine for the last few weeks against the decision of their president to break off talks with Europe and move closer to Russia? Does he agree that if there is any further violence against them, then those who are responsible should be held personally accountable? And will he continue to hold out the prospect of closer links with Europe in the longer term, which is what the people of Ukraine want?
Well, first of all, I absolutely agree with my honourable friend that we should pay tribute to those in Ukraine who want to have a future linked to Europe and want the peace and the prosperity and the stability that that relationship would bring. I think we should also say, as he has said very clearly, that the world is watching what the Ukrainian authorities have done and are contemplating doing in response to these demonstrations. And I think we should stand with the people of Ukraine who want that peaceful, secure and prosperous future.
Well, it's a bit of history now, really, because, of course, it is all reasonably peaceful there. Deals have been signed. It's not quite as bad as it was certainly a couple of weeks ago with the thoughts of riots on the streets with the Ukrainian police and the protesters.
Yes, and in actual fact, what they're failing to recognise is that the Ukrainian government is the democratically elected government of Ukraine, and they have made the decision to go with Russia.
They were actually only elected last year, weren't
they?
And now they're saying, well, no, we don't like this.
Well, that's what happens with Western politicians, is when people go to the streets to protest against governments they don't like, they're all in favour of the protesters. But I didn't see David Cameron lining up with the protesters in Egypt, for example, or lining up with the protesters in Turkey, although he did line up with the protesters in Syria. Now, what have we got here? What we've got is the West picking favourites. They are all in favour of protesters against regimes they don't like, even if they're democratically elected. And the regimes they do like, even if they're not democratically elected, can stay in power, like the one in Bahrain. They've not had any elections in Bahrain at all, but we support the regime there because they are pro-Western. It's all about geopolitics. Well, so there's nothing to do with human rights at all. It's just a load of guff.
The BBC quoting Prime Minister Azarov. I'm not quite sure which country he's Prime Minister of, but they're saying the deal that's been struck with Putin saved the country from bankruptcy. So it really is all about money, was it?
Well, ultimately, yes. I mean, the tensions between the West and Russia need to be properly resolved. The West are still threatening to put missiles into East European countries, which are very threatening to the Russians. It's totally unnecessary, and they claim that they're directed at the Iranians. And Putin, at one of these NATO, at one of these summits that they have, said, look, if you want to deter the Iranians, we've got the president of Azerbaijan here. You can put your missiles in Azerbaijan, right next to Iran. What about that, instead of sticking them in Poland in our face? And the merit of the West just said, ugh. Now, the Russian general staff know very well that those missiles are directed at them. Therefore, they're not happy to have the Ukraine join the Western camp, because joining the Western camp means that they can't be in the Russian camp, because the West's attitude towards Russia is so hostile. This puts Ukraine in a dilemma. The Russian-speaking East doesn't want to go towards the European Union. The Western, the Ukrainian-speaking West does. This is Bosnia on a big scale with nuclear weapons. That's the danger.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, we have this organisation called AFRICOM, don't we, which is the Americans' African Command, which seems to be keeping an eye on the United States and really also managing some of the interventions over there. And we've seen a couple over the last few weeks. One in the Central African Republic, a Guardian reporting yesterday that there's atrocities escalating there. The UN envoy, Samantha Power, is calling for urgent action as Human Rights Watch charts killings by Muslims and Christians. Also in South Sudan, similar kind of thing, with lots of troops being flown into the country, it seems. It almost like there's another wave of colonialism, but how genuine is the real unrest going on in these places, or is it just an excuse to bring the colonial troops
in? Well, to be honest with you, I'm absolutely cynical about all of this. They're competing with the Chinese for influence in Africa. A lot of the problems in Africa are actually generated by Western intelligence services. So, for example, the whole intervention in Libya led to the takeover of northern Mali by extremist groups, which then leads to a further intervention in Mali, which will then spill over into some other country and encourage. I mean, the setting up of AFRICOM is very interesting because they've got these commands that cover the whole of the world. The American and British and policy is to have people running the whole world. So you've got CENTCOM, which runs the Middle East, AFRICOM, EURICOM, and all the rest of it. AFRICOM was set up a few years ago, and they invited all of these African countries to join AFRICOM, which was going to be the US-led security structure. And most of them said, we don't want to join AFRICOM, we don't want AFRICOM. So the headquarters of AFRICOM, believe it or not, are in Germany, because no national government in Africa wants them. But they're going to get it anyway, because they need help, they need support. They can't just be allowed to get on with their own business. And this, of course, is all part of the strategy for keeping the Chinese out of the West African oil market, etc. The games that are being played are very similar to the 19th century, but they're being played with 21st century weapons, and the West are not the good guys.
Now, we're hearing from Reuters today, a militia has attacked Muslims in the Central African Republic's capital. Christian militia attacked Muslim neighbourhoods in the capital of Central African Republic on Friday, as France appealed to European partners for assistance in quelling months of religious violence in its former colony. Pastor Antoine Mbago Bogo, who's the president of the local Red Cross, said his staff had recovered 29 bodies from northern neighbourhoods of Bangui following the clashes, which began late on Thursday. Again, it seems there's this sectarian violence. But to what extent is this really a religious battle, or are these just kind of more cultural or ethnic fights?
Well, these tensions exist in all societies, but they're being manipulated by outside powers. Look what happened in Syria, where you've got the al-Nusra Front and other al-Qaeda-linked groups who are fighting the Assad regime, but they're getting direct and indirect support from Western intelligence services. This should be ringing a bell in people's minds. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which was the main Schwerpunkt of the attack which overthrew Gaddafi, they've been working with the Western intelligence services for years. More Libyans fought in Afghanistan in the 1980s than any other nationality. All trained by British and American operatives, SAS, MI6, etc. The linkages between these extremist jihadi groups and the Western intelligence services go back a long way. So what happens is they provoke something like the Islamic Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The guys who set that up were ex-Guantanamo Bay inmates, but they've been on what they call Penny Lane rather than Strawberry Fields. Penny Lane means that they're on the way out, so they get turned and then they get sent back into the field as operatives of the CIA. So don't think about Al-Qaeda as completely infiltrated by MI6 CIA. Abdul Hakim Belhaj, the head of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, worked with British intelligence for many years, part of Al-Qaeda. Can't people see what's happening here? Iranians are very clear about this.
Can you explain these Beatles songs references, Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields?
Guantanamo. They're in Guantanamo Bay, they're holding people, many of whom are innocent, some of whom are jihadis, but what happens is they convert them to working for the Western intelligence services, and then they send them back into the field as jihadis to infiltrate these organisations. And they did the same with the Red Brigades in Italy. There was infiltrations even to the highest levels of the IRA, people like Donaldson and so on. Now, this is how this stuff works. So you then create the Al-Qaeda was originally set up by the Western intelligence services to funnel these jihadi extremists into Afghanistan in the 1980s. It was originally a database. Al-Qaeda means the base. It was a database in Jordan held by the Jordanian intelligence services on behalf of the Western powers, which had a list of all of these jihadis who would be then sent off to do various jobs around the world. What the Western intelligence services claim is they then lost control of this structure. I don't believe them. They tell lies.
The Daily Telegraph.
They did lose control of the structure.
The Daily Telegraph reported back in November CIA turned Al Qaeda double agents, as you were saying, at Guantanamo base called Penny Lane. A row of comfortable, eight comfortable cottages, complete with private kitchens, showers, and pornography on Guantanamo Bay, where Al-Qaeda terrorists were turned. CIA used this secret base, nicknamed Penny Lane, to turn some of Al-Qaeda's most dangerous terrorists to double agents. Inmates languishing under Guantanamo Bay's harsh regime were offered cash rewards, hotel-style rooms, and even pornography if they agreed to help the CIA track down and kill fellow Al-Qaeda operatives. Instead of the Spartan cells, they would be transferred to cottages with private kitchen, showers, and TVs, as well as their own patio. A handful then signed agreements to work for the CIA. So this starts to look as if you've got a mishmash out there of some people who are genuine, if you can call them that, extremist enthusiasts, plus some of these people who are there to sort of almost encourage them and infiltrate, and they've got to prove themselves, haven't they, by being great fighters or whatever.
Well,
for Al Qaeda,
if you look at the analysis of what happened in the Omar bomb, for example,
this is in Northern Ireland.
When you've infiltrated these groups, the question is at what point do you if your infiltrators are going to have credibility, they've got to be terrorists as well. And in any case, I actually believe the Western intelligence services are engaged in the commission of terrorism. They're not just using these techniques to try and capture the terrorists. They are actually creating terrorism. As we mentioned in the first hour, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Imposimato, has written a book where he accuses the NATO intelligence services of carrying out all the terrorism in Italy in the 70s and the 80s, and hundreds of people died. Red Brigades terrorism, fascist terrorism, all being manipulated by NATO. How does he know? Police investigations by the Italian police force. These people who are running these intelligence services are spying on everybody. Yes, we were talking about that in the first hour as well. But they are also the terrorists, which is why we need police officers, proper police officers, to arrest them, and that includes four-star generals.
Well, also from this article from the Daily Telegraph on the 26th of November, also nicknamed the Marriott, this is Penny Lane, because of its comfortable conditions. Its biggest luxury in inmates' eyes was its beds, which were proper mattresses rather than military-issue cots. Its name was a nod to the classic Beatles song, also a riff from another secret facility at Guantanamo Bay known as Strawberry Fields. The latter, which was used to hold high-value inmates, got its nickname from the song Strawberry Fields Forever, because of the threat that the detainees would be held there forever. Officials said that of 779 people who were taken to Guantanamo Bay, a few dozen were considered for Penny Lane programming. Only a fraction of them ever went to work on for the CIA. So they're saying this is really small potatoes, Martin.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they, is all I can say. And deception is their trade. Al-Qaeda was set up by the Western intelligence services in the 1980s to put people like Abdul Hakim Belhaj, the head of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, into Afghanistan. They were trained by the SAS. The SAS trained people in Scotland, jihadis, in the 1980s, when Margaret Thatcher was in charge, the glorious Margaret Thatcher, the beatified Margaret Thatcher. She, with Ronald Reagan, created Al-Qaeda. Now, at what point did the intelligence services lose control of Al-Qaeda? They say at one minute we were running them and we defeated the Russians. Wasn't that brilliant? The next minute they just set off on their own plan. I don't believe them. I believe they've been running them all along. And in actual fact, that's what the Italian police force believe as well. And ultimately, lots of people are going to prison. And under existing US law, a lot of US generals need to be executed. Suggest lethal injection.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, it's calmed down a little bit from the lethal injections, and time to talk now to Freya Lawton. Now, Freya, you have started something called the Peace Intention. I don't think you're contemplating lethal injections, are you?
Not this evening, no. But no, it's interesting listening to what you've just been talking about and this growing perception that there is so much misinformation, so much manipulation of our fears and our, particularly our fear of other people, whether it's other religions or other nations or other political persuasions. And actually, I think it's got to the point now where we've got you know, 7 billion people on this planet, and I think most of them would prefer to live in peace and stop being part of this manufactured consent for war.
Now, I mean, at the top of the hour, I introduced really your peace intention idea as almost a little bit like the First World War and the first Christmas of the First World War. They weren't allowed to do it again, mind you. The first Christmas day, the first Christmas day that the soldiers were out playing football in no man's land. Now, what are your thoughts about whether that really is a possibility that in the future? Because quite clearly, it's in the benefits of the vast majority, peace rather than war.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, war's the biggest industry on this planet at the moment. It's making a huge amount of money for a very small number of people. It's destroying millions and millions and millions of lives. It's causing us to hate people that we have no need to hate. It's causing us to live our lives in fear, even in our own homes. And basically, I think that what happened on that Christmas Day during World War One, where they all just ceasefired and I think had a game of football, to me is a reflection of the truth of human nature. If you actually take away the fear and you take away the manipulation and you take away the role of governments and media in, you know, exaggerating our fears and causing us to, you know, create these barriers between us, that actually my belief is that most people have an altruistic feeling towards other people. They want to help other people. They want to do what's right. And I don't think we need to be told what that is. I think we know what it is. And I think increasingly people are saying, look, no more of this. That actually what we wanted to start doing is breaking down these barriers, recognizing that they're actually artificial and manipulated, and seeing through the lies in the media and seeing through the manipulation of our fears and saying, actually, we can come together and decide that we are going to intend to create something called peace. And I say something called peace because I think it's something that we've almost become embarrassed to talk about. I think it's something that has become a bit of a joke, the idea that we could create world peace. It's become, again, manipulated by the media to make us think that this is a complete impossibility. Well, I agree, it's impossible until we decide otherwise, because nothing happens on this planet without intent. And, you know, once we start to decide that that is actually what we're going to do, then 7 billion people have the right to do it.
Well, we had something after the Cold War, didn't we, called the peace dividend, supposedly. Mm-hmm. Now it seems to be called the war on terror, which
exactly.
is the permanent war forever. Yeah. Now, look, millions of people out there thinking like you, Freya. What was the journey that brought you to actually do something about it?
Well, I've been working with small groups and individuals for quite a few years, looking at how our beliefs affect our experience of life, and not only our experience of life, but our relationships with ourselves and with each other, and how easy it is once we begin to see the kind of fears and anxieties that we're all walking around with, that we can actually let them go and create a completely different experience of other people. A much more compassionate, much more accepting, much more open, much more meaningful relationship with basically anyone and everyone that we meet. And basically, I just woke up one day and said, well, hang on a minute, why don't we just apply this reasoning? If this is working for individuals, why don't we just create a vehicle where people can access this information and start to do this en masse with the intent to create peace, which is basically breaking down the barriers. That's what, to me, that's what peace is. It's creating a state of acceptance of everything that we experience and everyone that we experience, which we can do very quickly if we decide to.
I suppose before you shoot somebody, you're probably judging them, aren't you?
And
you maybe
might be.
Maybe actually not judging so much might be a good way of stopping people shooting each other. But anyway, your website is thepeaceintention.org.
That's right.
You're asking people to sign a peace declaration. What effect's that going to have?
Well, the peace declaration is really for people to just draw a line in the sand for themselves. It's something they can download and sign. And in a sense, it doesn't mean anything, but it means a huge amount. It's basically making a commitment to yourself to start creating more peace in your own life and in your own community. And it's a commitment really to, you know, the rest of humanity, if you like, of saying, actually, I am going to take responsibility for doing something about this. Because personally, I don't believe that you know, bashing our heads against government is going to get this to happen, because they have a vested interest in war. They have a vested interest in, you know, continuing to create and, you know, stimulate conflict around the world. And no matter how many people are on the streets, they are not going to turn around and say, OK, you win, we give in, let's end war. We've got to start building this from the bottom up. And, you know, we saw it with Iraq, and it's quite an interesting issue in terms of democracy, actually, that I've spoken to a lot of people that are involved in Stop the War and anti-war campaigning. You know, we had 1 million people on the streets before the Iraq war in London alone, demanding that we didn't attack Iraq. Now, the fact is, if they had actually had their way, if that 1 million people had actually been listened to by the government, would the 60-odd million other people who actually were fearful of al-Qaeda, were fearful of what was being done, or they were being told was being done in Iraq, were fearful of these so-called long-range missiles that they actually didn't find, these, you know, weapons of mass destruction that were never found. But the point is that the majority of people are still living in fear. And so those people, I think, would have had a right to say this is not democratic for that 1 million people that were against the war to be listened to. And I think that's the point. We've got to stop dismantling our own fear.
But aren't the people with the guns always going to lord it over the people who are saying, no, we want peace?
Yeah, I think they are. But I think this is a project that's for the people with the guns as well. I mean, I was just talking to somebody who is an ex-serviceman and says, actually, there is huge amount of you know, people in the services who are actually saying and questioning what they're doing in Iraq, what they've been doing in Afghanistan. You know, the Veterans for Peace charities and projects that have started in America and now started in the UK are ex-servicemen coming back saying, actually, we've been lied to.
Okay, finally, Freya, what would you like people to do other than have a look at your website, sign the peace declaration?
Yeah, the other thing that you can do, if you sign the declaration, there's also a book there which is free to download, which I wrote, which is the Peace Intention Handbook. And that's basically a really simple book that just has a few ideas in it about how we can begin to dismantle these barriers between us.
Well, Freya Lawton, whereabouts are you from in Somerset? You're in Somerset, aren't
Froome.
You? From Froome. Fantastic. Lovely to have you on this evening. Lovely way to finish. Time to sign off now. No Cyrus the Virus till after Christmas. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That was Kevin Carhill. And we'll be here with our alcohol-free sherry and mince pies at the usual time, though, next Friday. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a great weekend and a great Christmas.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Nigella Lawson says she's disappointed but unsurprised by the acquittal of two former aides on fraud charges. The TV cook says the jury was faced with...